Okay, and I'm talking to Dick Bunce on, this is the 20th?
20th of October.
Of October 1994 at KPFA in Berkeley. And I want to start off asking you the same question I've asked everybody else, which has proved terribly productive, and I've hardly had to open my mouth thereafter, which is, how did you happen to become involved with KPFA and Pacifica Radio?
Well, there are a lot of windows into this institution for me. I was doing a dissertation in sociology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison on the regulation of commercial broadcasting on the history of the attempts to regulate commercial broadcasting with an eye towards how do you maximize the public interest, particularly the news and public affairs dimension of broadcasting. And I was so frustrated that the range of experience within commercial broadcasting in that area was so narrow. And
remember Eleanor McKinney saying that it was like trying to teach pacifism in the army?
Excellent analogy. Exactly, exactly. So I had never lived within earshot of a Pacifica station. I had grown up in New Orleans. I had gone to undergraduate school in Ohio, graduate school in Wisconsin, and had read about Pacifica Radio but didn't know what it was. But because of the work I was doing in my research and writing, I was very interested in what Pacifica had to offer. And another dimension of that story is that I was really also more interested in activism and in trying to do something to make media that would make a difference than I was in writing and researching and teaching about a lot of media that basically didn't satisfy me and that disappointed me. So so when I moved to the Bay Area, one of the first things I wanted to do was find out what the air sound of Pacifica was like.
So and you're one of the ones that knew that it existed.
I knew
already.
It existed before I came here, and I was one of the natural resources of the Bay Area and Berkeley, where I first came and settled. And that started in 1973 when I first became a listener. In 1985, I was asked to join the Community Advisory Board of KPFA.
And so that was by David Salinger, was it?
David asked me to join, yeah. A friend, a colleague that I had worked with, Gary Delgado from the Center for Third World Organizing, had been on the board and had encouraged David to get acquainted with me. David and I met at a demonstration on Market Street in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Someone pointed him out to me. He came up across and asked me if I'd consider getting onto the board. It seemed like just the right way to be invited onto the KPFA board.
And what had been your professional experience between the time that you arrived in Berkeley and started listening and that point at which you were asked to join the board?
Well, a lot of different things, including being for a while at the university as a research sociologist at something called the Social Research Group. But more relevant to this work here, I was on the staff of Mother Jones Magazine in San Francisco. I was director of national affairs, and I had previously been with Socialist Review, which is an intellectual bimonthly.
Could you tell us just a little bit briefly about Mother Jones Magazine, so I have something to identify it with?
Yeah, Mother Jones is a calls itself a progressive, hell-raising publication. It's the largest circulation sort of slick magazine that's got a political point of view coming from the left. Its circulation has bounced around 150,000 to 250,000 in the 20 years or so that it's been around.
It's still going,
right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that at one time, I don't know if still, Barbara Ehrenreich wrote for them.
Yes. She's still an occasional contributor, but not so regular these days.
Yeah. For them and for Time Magazine, which is quite a span.
Right. We like Barbara to get as large an audience as she possibly can. So it's great that she's writing for Time. Don't begrudge that a bit.
Yeah. God, I have to throw in here. I've read in The Guardian and clipped, I wish I'd brought it with me, a very witty article about her return to Berkeley a few months ago, in which she discovered, she said, that all the passion that had been attached to left-wing activism in Berkeley had moved over to food.
I knew you would say that.
It was very witty indeed. And, of course, she cited Alice Waters and
right.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Anyway, you were telling me what you had been doing.
So my entree into KPFA was really as a member of the Community Advisory Board. And David at that time, 1985, was trying to prepare this organization. David Salnicker, who was the general manager then, was trying to prepare this organization for the notion of bigger things and renewal, and particularly talking about a campaign to find a new home for the station. Mm-hmm.
Had you been working in fundraising before you came onto the board?
Yes, I was, mm-hmm. and I was doing that at Mother Jones Magazine at the time.
Mm-hmm. So that was a key element,
right.
I gather, in your value to the station.
Right, and I jumped in and played a role in helping David to basically organize a board and a station into being ready to do such a campaign.
David said that there was a point at which the key staff actually went off to fundraiser school to learn how to do it. If that's correct.
I think that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we had to do a lot of training because I think that the kind of campaign that's necessary to really build an institution in terms of bricks and mortar and equipment. This is a $3.5 million building we're sitting in terms of the cost of the property and everything we've built here. To move to that kind of level really requires a kind of fundraising outreach that's very different from what everyone at the station is comfortable with, which is going on the air and asking people for money, and asking mm-hmm. people for money in the denominations of $40 and $50 and maybe $100, and if you're lucky, mm-hmm. or really lucky, $200.
Sitting out on the pavement with a cup and a sign yeah. reading, "We'll talk for food."
Mm-hmm. Whereas what built this building were chiefly 55 gifts. And so being able to identify those 55 givers and being able to approach them and cultivate an excitement in them in what the potential this organization is and what its legacy is, and making them part of a project to renew it and build this new building and equip it properly. That's a very different kind of enterprise than reaching thousands of people on the air.
Are they publicly listed?
Yes. Most of them are, yeah. About 25 or 30 are listed on a plaque that's right out in the lobby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there any little pamphlet that contains this information that one can walk away with?
Unfortunately, there isn't. No. Mm-hmm. We produced some nice reports to try to kindle excitement in the campaign mm-hmm. and suggest something of the promise and potential. But after we were successful, we sort of felt like the building spoke for itself. I don't think there's anything in the way of a brochure mm-hmm. that really does that. It's a good idea, though. We should do that.
Because one always sees in the programs of San Francisco Symphony or the opera or mm-hmm. what have you, mm-hmm. Of course, it's going over the top to sort of do it every time. Every folio, here's a list of the people. Mm-hmm. But at some point, unless there were some good reasons for not doing so, a list of these are the people who made it possible.
Yeah. Well, I think KPFA's annual report tries to do that on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm.
And we did put plaques up a general plaque for the building as a whole, which lists many of the gifts, and then donors at a certain level were able to dedicate the room that they were funding to someone who was one of the KPFA founders, whoever they chose. Mm-hmm. Many of them chose founders of KPFA, others chose intellectuals or musicians or artists that were inspirational to them. Mm-hmm. Others named them after their family members. Mm-hmm. So,
did you have any large contributors who asked to remain anonymous?
Yes, a number. But far fewer than everyone at the station thought would be the case. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any off-the-cuff observation as to what kinds of people fell into this large gift category?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because I think I came at it assuming that most of the people would be motivated to give generously to KPFA because of a political commitment, because I think first and foremost that's what brought me to this institution. But what I discovered was that they were also like me in some other ways, in that I love to be able, when I first discovered KPFA, I loved to find the blues programs, the gospel programs, the new music programming, and there were a number of people who for whom KPFA was first and foremost a cultural touchstone, a source of continuing interest and inspiration to them. A lot of people that I talked to and who gave large gifts were artists or writers or composers and musicians who tuned into KPFA for some spark in their own creative work. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of people who gave for that reason, as well as people who gave because they understood the power of radio to really organize people politically, almost. The capacity to use radio to really not only change the way people thought about things or felt about things, but also the actions that they were willing to take. And just, you know, very simply, if a demonstration against a war like the Persian Gulf mm-hmm. War in 1991 is being covered and announced from Market Street on KPFA, everyone who has any possibility of going to such a demonstration is probably listening to KPFA and trying to decide whether to go down to Market Street and join in. So there were a lot of people, and I'd say that the largest part of our donors came from a community of lifelong political activists and from different parts of that community of political activism, peace community, as well as environmental community, as well as some others, too. So,
it's my feeling, and more than feeling, I'd say my observation, that an awful lot of the people who grew up with the enthusiasm and the idealism of the 1960s, mm-hmm. Who have subsequently gone on for various reasons, such as families, to earning a living, and have done rather well at it, have not thrown out the things that they felt and thought mm-hmm. in the 1960s, mm-hmm. and still hunger after expressions of that particular kind mm-hmm. of vision.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true, and it's also it's seen very clearly in a generation of people who were active, particularly in the 40s and early 50s in the Communist Party, who were because of all of the anti-communism and the red baiting, who were forced to become independently economically self-sufficient. A lot of these people were thrown out of the jobs at all levels, whether they were working in labor unions or whether they were working in companies, and had to find a way to start their own businesses and sort of make their own money. And that generation, and a lot of these people left the Communist Party in the 40s and 50s, But that generation held on to its political consciousness, really, and activity. And KPFA has always been a very important crossroads for some of that community. And a number of those people were very important now that they are in their late 60s, 70s, and 80s. They also have the wherewithal to give big gifts, and the number of those people had an important place in the success of this project.
Yeah. That's terrific, because a lot of those people were, among other things, the smartest people of their generation. Mm-hmm. And it is inevitable that if they went into self-employment of some sort or another, mm-hmm. and did it with intelligence, mm-hmm. That they were very likely to be successful
mm-hmm.
at it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. They're also such interesting people to spend time with, to develop a relationship with, to learn some history from firsthand. And it's one of the things that that made my job a pleasure. A lot of people.
You must have met a lot of legendary figures.
I did, yeah. But sometimes people who weren't so legendary were also just as interesting in terms of some of the stories they had to tell you, but also how they revealed themselves. But so much of my job involved connecting with people who had, you know, had a little role in different parts of our political history, and it's a lot of fun to do this, actually.
So you find, I think you said that in searching out people to support the building project, mm-hmm. That you developed a roster of people who have been prepared to continue to be involved mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. Additional expansive activities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And my job now really involves working with all of the Pacifica stations to try to help them upgrade. So I'm not mm-hmm. as deeply involved in working with KPFA directly now and mm-hmm. in this kind of work. In a way, KPFA is a model for all of the rest of the Pacifica stations. And so what we're trying to do is kind of bring that religion and mm-hmm. the experience and the skill that we've developed here and try to bring it to the rest of the stations. So at this moment, KPFT in Houston is getting ready to launch a capital campaign, and one of the founders of KPFT died in the last couple of years and left the property to the station. WBAI is getting ready to launch a kind of modest campaign, first for equipment, and then that'll be kind of a test drive to see if they're successful with that, they'll be able to move to a campaign to actually buy property in New York and do there what KPFA's done here. So this whole project does continue to hopefully reproduce itself.
Mm-hmm. Would it be accurate to say that KPFA is on the soundest financial footing of the Pacifica stations at
yeah,
the moment?
Most definitely. It has the largest budget. It's about $2,150,000 a year. It has the most diversified support of any of the Pacifica stations. Less than half of the funds that it raises come from on-air pledge drives. And a lot of community-based stations and all the other Pacifica stations are much, much more dependent on their on-air fundraising for their operating expenses, with some of them expecting to raise 80% of their annual operating expenses from on-air pledge drives. KPFA raises more money off the air than it raises on the air, but it raises them from the people who give on the air, but it simply moves past that on-air giving situation and develops a relationship with those givers, with those donors outside of the broadcast time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, David explained to me this morning what I had not realized, that When Reagan sort of threw the doors wide open and deregulated, that it was that for Pacifica Radio it was kind of like striking oil, and that suddenly there was a sizable amount of money that coming which had not come before because such stations were not eligible for it,
right.
And being able to use subcarriers the use of it, right. And also an expanse in governmental support for the stations matching money and for a certain percentage and that sort of thing.
Right.
So paradoxically, old Reagan actually did a tremendous favor for the Pacifica stations in a couple of respects.
Right. But it's been to Pacifica's management and board's credit that it's been able to use that opportunity as effectively as it has. There are a lot of other public radio stations that, even those in large markets, which have not been able to turn those subcarrier authorizations into the kind of revenue-generating project that Pacifica has been able to do. That money has really gone back to seed all kinds of new activity at the stations.
Mm-hmm.
For a number of years, it was more or less earmarked just for helping with capital expenses.
Mm-hmm.
But we've gone beyond that to.
Yeah, David told me that it was in the first instance to eliminate indebtedness.
Yeah.
And then to, sound financial planning at KPFA?
Mm-hmm.
Impossible. Such a thing never existed.
we've tried to make retooling the fundraising and development part of the stations a major emphasis in the period from about 89 to 93, and really starting at the national level, hiring development director, I took that job. But then this past year, 93-94, is the first time that all the stations in Pacifica have had their own development directors. Part of what...
Have you had any... have you played any part in selecting them?
Right, I have, and in training them. And all of these development directors that we've had that we've hired in this past 18-month period, none of them came from public broadcasting. None of them had any experience in public radio, but all of them came from outside with a lot of experience in the kinds of fundraising that's fairly routine and sophisticated in nonprofit organizations, but was still fairly new for a lot of Pacifica stations. So we're trying to marry a lot of new techniques with our institutions. But we've used these revenues from our SCA leases to create our own little grant systems for innovation and experimentation in the development side. And so we've asked each of the stations to come to us with proposals about new things that they would try to do in fundraising area, with an eye towards really trying to improve the financial health of all of these other stations, because KPFA has, as I said, set the pace for a lot of things, but the rest of the stations need to adopt a lot of these innovations. And so we've been able to use these carrots of funds from the SCA to fund new projects in fundraising, which then, once they're successful, and most of them have been, get incorporated into those local stations' ongoing fundraising activity and into their budgets. We did that for a period of about 3.5 years, and beginning this past year, we've started to shift, and now programming and audience development and program innovation is going to be the focus of this. And this time, Pacifica has about $40,000 available to make mini grants to its various stations for to follow through with new ideas in programming, and we hope to build this pool over the next year. So we're using these new monies from the subcarriers very strategically to try to first improve our financial health, and second, basically improve what the radio sound is at all of our stations. So it's Reagan's deregulating of the SCA had an effect that I'm sure he would be appalled to consider.
If he were capable of understanding it. Have the other stations been able to use their subcarriers as effectively as KPFA
has?
They're all
managed by Pacifica. Mm-hmm. So okay. Pacifica, the national office basically, and the board basically handle mm-hmm. that on behalf of all the stations. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I gather from talking to Marcy earlier is that there are all kinds of ways, including programming, in which the Pacifica stations are coming closer together, becoming more integrated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've tried to do a little bit more in the way of national programming in the past 4 or 5 years than our stations have been ready for. National mm-hmm. programming has an interesting history, starting with the News Bureau in the very late 70s in Washington, having been established, and then with the during the Iran-Contra period in the middle 80s, there was a lot of national programming of hearings from Washington, which we found built our audiences tremendously. And we saw our audiences increase 60% and 70% through our coverage of these national hearings. In the past 10 years, we've often gone to major hearings, Supreme Court nomination confirmation hearings, debates on funding the Contras in the House of Representatives, different kinds of Washington-based programs, which we've interrupted our regularly, locally scheduled and produced programming for national broadcasts, and seen the same thing happen in terms of our audiences. That led us to think that for an organization with our financial restrictions and limitations, that if we could create more national programming on a regularly scheduled basis, we could build the audiences of our stations much more efficiently than if we tried to build up each of the local programs at 5 different sites. That it would be much more cost effective. So our idea was to improve and make the daily evening news a regular feature of each of the stations, and to begin to try to create a morning program, borrowing a little bit from the NPR tent poles concept of using national productions at the largest audience times of the day. Mm-hmm. But our stations have such deep roots in their communities that they have really not wanted to have a national satellite distributed program coming to them in the morning. And mm-hmm. we face a situation right now where 4 of the 5 stations basically are committed to developing their own locally based morning programs, even if it means that in the midst of certain kinds of national emergencies, that certain luminaries and intellectuals will get 5 phone calls from 5 Pacifica station
yes.
morning news people,
exactly
all of whom
what Marcy
want them
said.
To be interviewed, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, namely, some dramatic event happens in the Caribbean, and mm-hmm. And Noam Chomsky can't get mm-hmm. off the telephone.
Right, he has to go from WBAI and WPFW in the east, and as the time zone changes, then he has to talk to Houston, and then just when he's when lunchtime's coming around for him, it's time to talk to KPFA.
Yes, he needs a tape recorder. Mm-hmm. He needs a tape machine, really, to say what he has to say and play it mm-hmm. on the for the successive people that phone him up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly it is a dichotomy, as I was talking to Marcy about, and as she not only readily agreed, but emphasized that on the one hand. Pacifica's desire to treat important issues on a really large and significant scale.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, it's lifelong history of being closely involved in the local communities.
Mm-hmm. Which has really been a source of constant renewal, I think. The fact it's our community base that brings into us new generations and new waves of people who think they have something to say or think they have something to bring to the attention of an audience that no one else is doing. And there's room in each of our stations for that to happen. And so having that degree of openness and accessibility, which is what locally based broadcasting provides, volunteer-based broadcasting, that's led to renewals of what the Pacifica Sound has been in the 60s, in the 70s, and I think we're going to see some more in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important, and I don't for a minute... I think that the balance between some nationally based broadcasts which tap into national level people and resources and international ones are an important component of the whole mix. But it's our local base that keeps us alive and vital and changing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one nice thing that Marcy said was that people call in indignantly saying that there's not enough representation on the air anymore of gay rights at KPFA. And she said her response is that battle has virtually been won, and that how can you complain about the lack of representation of gay interests on a station in which the management of it has in which they are very largely
mm-hmm.
highly
mm-hmm.
representative.
Mm-hmm.
it's like calling up Antarctica and saying, why aren't you saying more about the rights of penguins?
And Pacifica has also carried its defense of a broadcast of Jerker, a play that was excerpted on KPFK in Los Angeles, which involved some fairly frank discussion between two gay men on the telephone, one of whom was dying of AIDS. And we've been involved in fighting the battle to preserve our ability to do such broadcasts and not have our license challenged. That goes back to 1986, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That same, while the Jerker decision itself was resolved, the issue in about 1991 at a court case after we spent several years, and I'm sorry to say, more than $100,000 defending ourselves.
I'll bet you must have gotten some rather favorable treatment from lawyers for the bill to be that low.
You're right. I know, most of the lawyers thought they weren't getting paid. They said those were the expenses of Xeroxing and everything else. They were donating it all pro bono. But just yesterday, Allen Ginsberg recited Howl on the steps of the District Court in the District of Columbia, the Circuit Court in the District of Columbia, as Pacifica is once again having to defend itself on the indecency issue, this time before an 11-judge panel in which our ability to broadcast all kinds of things that most high school students today are reading in their literature classes and writing essays about, but which we are prohibited by certain FCC rules from actually being able to read verbatim on the air. So that case actually still continues.
And that's going on right now.
Right now, yeah. The oral arguments were yesterday. We had a press conference in Washington around
this
yesterday.
Is this Supreme Court?
No, this is a district court. It's the level below. I've said circuit and I've said district, and you know, I'd have to
mm-hmm.
check to be sure, but yeah. It's the level below
mm-hmm.
the
Because
the
I have read
court.
Recently that the Supreme Court have have been recently rejecting a whole lot of appeals.
Denying certiorari, right, to everything. I think they said they would hear no new cases the last term, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so all matters that involve the FCC are sent directly to the court that sits in the District of Columbia, that's the court directly below the Supreme Court. So we're hoping, since we won the decision that a three-judge panel heard, since we won that, we're hoping that the appeal to the full court will be able to win that one as well. We don't think this will need to go to the Supreme Court. We have basically won this case at every level. This is over what constitutes mm-hmm. indecency.
It's very ironic, of course. I don't need to tell you. I think back a number of years ago, one of the programs which got Pacifica into a lot of trouble was one which was sent them on tape from the WFMT in Chicago. That they had broadcast without any difficulty,
but as soon as Pacifica broadcasted, then Pacifica
got into trouble on it. It didn't retroactively get WFMT into trouble.
There are a lot of people listening for us to do something which they can then use to try to challenge our license. This is particularly true in Southern California, where there have been a lot of initially fundamentalist Christian interests who have been outraged at what they've heard on Pacifica, but it's spread to other interests as well.
Yeah, I know. Ironically, just a very few years back, at the same time that Pacifica was being commended for its for its free speech activities. Mm-hmm. It was also being having its hand slapped for having broadcast excerpts from the Satanic Verses.
I don't know why we'd have our hand slapped for broadcasting excerpts from that. I actually remember when KPFA did some broadcasting from Rushdie's book. And Alice Walker called Pat Scott, who was then the general manager of KPFA, when Rushdie was being, when the death sentence had gone out on him. And she said, do you think that we can read from the Satanic Verses on KPFA? And Pat and the program director at the time, I think it was Jenny Burson, who's once again program director here, I think everybody was excited about it. And I think Alice came in and did some of the reading herself.
Well, so it was Alice's suggestion.
It was Alice's suggestion, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it started.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And we read from, that we did about 3 hours of programming, about an hour worth of reading from it. And we got quite a few bomb threats that were called into the station, but nothing more than threats.
Yeah, of course, there are probably elements within some of the minority groups that broadcast on KPFA and have broadcast, who would be very unhappy at material which is blasphemous to Islam.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, the strains of the iconoclast temperament is still very strong here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that word may not be in our mission statement, but I think it's in the hearts and minds of most of the people who are part of Pacifica.
Yeah. Well, the reason that I mentioned this about being specifically condemned for, I think, profanity not anti-Islam, but for naughty words because I remember reading it in a San Francisco Chronicle news item that was sent to me, several years ago, and I think I mentioned it in my little monograph, quoting David Salinger on the subject, on the irony of the two, of being simultaneously praised for free speech policy and castigated for following it through. That was back at that point. I had no idea who David Salinger was, but it was a very good quote, so I used it. Well, is there anything? Is there any question that I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
Yes, but if I can't tell you. So.
Oh, come on.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I've actually got from you what I hoped that I would. That
Good.
Is the kind of information about specifically on the fundraising side
Good.
and your involvement there. So there's I can't think of a reason for prolonging this unnecessarily.
It's been nice talking with you, John.